Chapter 3. Breathing. The Sutta. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating the body as a body? Here, a bhikkhu, gone to the forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, set his body erect, and established mindfulness in front of him. Ever mindful, he breathes in, and mindful, he breathes out. Having laid down the four foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha goes on to recommend a particularly accessible method of developing mindfulness, the mindfulness of breathing. The fact that it is accessible is very important. The plain truth is, and we had better face this squarely, that awareness of any kind is not easy to develop. The Buddha's method is therefore to start by encouraging us to develop awareness of the aspect of our experience that is closest to us, the body. Even this is not as easy as one might think. The first of the four foundations may be mindfulness of the body, but it is hard to focus on the body as a whole. It is such a complex thing, within which all sorts of processes are going on at the same time. To lead your awareness towards a broader experience of the body, it is therefore best to begin by focusing on the breath. Breathing is a simple bodily activity, providing a relatively stable object of attention that is both calming and capable of sustaining one's interest. On this basis, you can go on to become aware of your bodily sensations and even of your feelings and thoughts, which are still more subtle and difficult to follow. The breath is available to us at every moment of our lives, and becoming aware of it has a calming effect at stressful times, as we know from the received wisdom of our own culture. Take a deep breath. But it is possible to cultivate a more systematic awareness of the breathing through a meditation which is widely practiced throughout the Buddhist world, the mindfulness of breathing, in Pali, Anapanasati, which some say was the meditation the Buddha was practicing when he gained enlightenment. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha launches straight into a description of how the bhikkhu should go about this practice. He is directed to go into the depths of the forest, or to the foot of a tree, or just an empty place. Then, sitting down with his legs crossed, he is to keep his body erect and his mindfulness alert, or established in front of him, and start to become aware of his breathing. Thus we learn straight away that the right place, the right time, and the right posture are all important for successful meditation. The right place, we gather, is a place of solitude. In the Buddha's time, of course, there was plenty of space in the depths of the forest for meditators to sit there for long periods without being disturbed. But I think the Buddha's instruction here means something more. We need to imagine what it would be like to take up this practice if you had always lived in the traditional Indian family, which was the core of Brahminical society in the Buddha's day. An Indian village, with all its noise and bustle, was hardly conducive to the development of mental calm, and the psychological and moral pull of the family group would have been just as inimical to spiritual practice. Even today in India, if you live in a traditional extended family, it can be very difficult to steer your life in a direction not dictated by your family. For anyone seeking an awakening to truth, simply going forth to the undisturbed solitude of the forest, abandoning anything to do with home and family life, at least for a while, was and continues to be a major step. Finding solitude is just as much of a challenge for us in the West today, although for us solitude might mean getting a respite from the world and worldly concerns, rather than literally getting away from other people. Indeed, the companionship of other people following the same spiritual tradition as yourself can be a great source of encouragement, especially when you're just starting out. To meditate in isolation, you need to know what you're doing and be very determined. It is all too easy for discouraging doubts to arise about whether you're doing the practice properly, and in the absence of an experienced guide, you might lose interest in meditation altogether. While the Buddha's instruction to seek out the foot of a tree certainly suggests finding a place where you are likely to be undisturbed for a while, it does not necessarily mean going off into the depths of the forest or isolating yourself from other meditators. People didn't always meditate alone, even in the Buddha's day. The Pali Suttas contain striking descriptions of the Buddha and his disciples sitting and meditating together, sometimes in very large numbers. We come upon such a scene at the beginning of the Samanyapala Sutta. On a full moon night, King Ajatasattu decides to have his elephants saddled up, all 500 of them, and ride with his entourage deep into the forest in search of the Buddha. It is quite a long way, and the king, who has a guilty conscience, is beset by all sorts of fears as they journey through the darkness. But at last they come upon the Buddha, seated in meditation with 1,250 monks, all of them perfectly concentrated and spread out before him like a vast clear lake. "The silence," says the sutta, "fills the guilty king, he has murdered his own father to gain the throne, with a nameless dread, making the hairs on his body stand on end. But he is sufficiently moved to ask to become a lay disciple of the Buddha on the spot." Since those early times, Buddhists throughout the tradition, especially in the Zen schools which place a particular emphasis on meditation, have well understood the benefits of collective practice. The Westerner learning to meditate is quite likely to do so alone, buying a book on the subject and beginning the practice in the comfort of his or her own home, but this is not to be recommended. It is hard to tell from the printed page how much experience the author has, and in any case, no book can cover every contingency. There is also the danger that you will end up just reading about Buddhist meditation and never getting around to doing any. It is certainly possible to learn the basic techniques from a book, but if you can, it is worth seeking out a meditation teacher and other meditators with whom to practice. As for the Buddha's instruction that the bhikkhu should sit cross-legged, this posture is recommended because it spreads the weight of the body more broadly and evenly than any other sitting position, and thus gives stability and enables you to sit comfortably for a long time. However, while it would have come naturally to the people of the Buddha's time and culture to sit cross-legged on the floor, we might find it more difficult. If so, any posture can be adopted, whether on the floor or on a chair, as long as it is stable and comfortable. Incidentally, this is another reason to go along to a meditation class, to get some help with working out a suitable meditation posture. Next, the monk is advised to keep his mindfulness alert or established in front of him. Some commentators suggest that this is an instruction to be mindful of the breath, which is, in a way, in front of you, but the meaning is probably less literal, referring simply to being undistracted. It's rather like the behaviour prescribed for a monk going for alms. He's supposed to keep his gaze on the ground about 6 feet in front of him, looking neither to the left nor right. This discipline is a very good preparation for meditation, helping one to become more aware of what one is doing and why, so that one does not let one's mind stray into unskillful thoughts. The Sutta. Breathing in long, he understands, "I breathe in long." Or breathing out long, he understands, "I breathe out long." Breathing in short, he understands, "I breathe in short." Or breathing out short, he understands, "I breathe out short." The precise details of the mindfulness of breathing are not recorded in any text, perhaps because the detailed ins and outs of the practice have traditionally been handed down from teacher to pupil by word of mouth. One can see the teaching of meditation in classes or groups as a continuation of that tradition. But the best method to start with is probably the traditional Theravadin practice of Anapanasati. This is divided into four stages, the first two of which involve counting the breaths to stop the mind from wandering and help you become aware of the breathing's dynamic yet gentle regularity. In the first stage, you count at the end of each out-breath. According to the commentaries, this corresponds to the phrase in the Satipatthana Sutta, which describes the meditator as knowing, "I am breathing in a long breath." There is nothing sacrosanct about this counting. In a sense, it doesn't matter what number you count to. In some traditions, you don't count at all. For example, there is a Thai method whereby you prevent the mind from straying by combining the inward and outward breathing with the pronunciation of the syllables bud and do. Buddho means awake. Other traditions go to the opposite extreme. Some Tibetan yogis count on indefinitely, even into the thousands. The Satipatthana Sutta itself makes no mention of counting. But the best method for the beginner is probably to count the breaths in groups of 10, as they do in the Theravadin tradition. Counting to 5 or less tends to restrict the mind unnecessarily, while going beyond 10 involves paying too much attention to keeping track of which number you've reached. Although you should be careful not to become so preoccupied with counting that you forget to concentrate on the breathing itself, it is a good idea to keep counting in these early stages of the practice. Experienced meditators may find that counting obstructs their concentration, but in that case, the counting tends to fall away quite naturally. If you are going to modify the practice, you need to be able to recognize the state of concentration you have reached and what to do to deepen it, and that calls for a good deal of experience. If you are a relative beginner, you may think that you are concentrating when all that has happened is that you have slipped into a light doze as your thoughts wander to and fro. Some beginners do become deeply absorbed in meditation, but it is rare to be able to stay concentrated. It is best to adopt a systematic method that will help you keep up the momentum of the practice. Once the first stage has been established, the sutta tells us that the meditator knows that he is breathing in a short breath. This can be taken to refer to the second stage of the Anapana practice, in which you change the emphasis slightly by counting before each in-breath rather than after each out-breath. Presumably a correspondence between the sutta's instructions at this point and the first two stages of the Anapana method is made, because the breath has a natural tendency to become a little longer in the first stage and a little shorter in the second. But you don't deliberately make the breaths shorter or longer. You just watch and count them as they come and go, steadily becoming more and more aware of the whole breathing process as you do so. In the early stages of meditation, much of your effort will be taken up with drawing the disparate energies of your mind and body together, and this involves recognizing the various ways in which the mind resists the process of deepening concentration. Traditionally, these forms of resistance are called the five hindrances, that is, doubt, sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, and restlessness. More will be said about this unsettling list of obstacles in a later chapter. Here it will suffice to say that, to begin with, one's effort in meditation is mainly directed towards avoiding them. Buddhaghosa's commentary on the Satipatthana Sutta Buddhaghosa was a celebrated scholar of the Pali texts who lived in the 4th century CE, compares the mind at this stage to a calf which, having been reared on wild cow's milk, has been taken away from its mother and tethered to a post. At first, unsettled and ill at ease in its unfamiliar surroundings, the calf dashes to and fro, trying to escape. But however much it struggles, it is held fast by the rope tethering it to the post. The rope, of course, symbolizes mindfulness. If your mindfulness holds firm, your mind will eventually be brought to a point where, like the wild calf, it finally stops trying to get away and settles down to rest in the inward and outward flow of the breath. For all its qualities of strength and steadfastness in the face of distraction, mindfulness is neither forceful nor aggressive in its quiet taming of the wayward mind. Like the rope, mindfulness has a certain pliancy. If you fix your attention too rigidly on the object of meditation, subtle states of concentration will have little opportunity to arise. The aim is a gradual process of unification. You guide your energies firmly until they harmonize about a single point, without strain or tension, and you are absorbed in the breathing for its own sake. A deep contentment will then lead quite naturally into concentration, as the traces of distraction fade away. The Sutta. He trains thus: I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of breath. He trains thus: I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of breath. He trains thus: I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the body formation. He trains thus: I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the body formation. Just as a skilled turner or his apprentice, when making a long turn, understands, I make a long turn, or when making a short turn, understands, I make a short turn. In the Anapana method, the first two stages of the practice are succeeded by two more, in the course of which your awareness of the breathing becomes increasingly refined. In stage three, you drop the counting altogether and give your attention to the breathing process as a whole, experiencing your breath rising and falling continuously and without effort, like a great ocean wave. You follow the breath going into the lungs, you feel it there, and you continue to experience it fully as it is breathed out. Note that the future tense used here, I shall breathe in, simply signifies the meditator's intention. It carries no suggestion that the breathing should be controlled in any way. Nor should the injunction to verbalize, even silently, be taken literally. If you become deeply concentrated, there will be no mental activity at all. Another possible source of confusion is the expression whole body of breath, which means simply the whole breath, not a subtle counterpart of the physical body, like the Hindu concept of prana. When you are experiencing the whole breath body, it is not just an awareness from the outside, but a total experience. You are identifying yourself with the breath. After some time, this subtle stage gives way to the fourth stage of the practice, which is more subtle still. Now you bring your attention to the first touch of the breath about your nostrils or upper lip, maintaining a delicate, minutely observed awareness of the breath's texture as it enters and leaves your body. Buddhaghosa compares this to a carpenter sawing timber, who keeps his attention fixed not on the saw as it moves back and forth, but on the spot where the saw's teeth are cutting into the wood. The sutta itself provides the analogy of a skillful wood turner, who knows precisely what kind of turn, long or short, he is making. For most of us, the reference will be somewhat obscure, but this is the kind of rural image the Buddha often used, and it would have been immediately clear to the people of village India in his own time. The basic principle of turning remains the same to this day. The turner shapes the wood by rotating a piece of timber at speed and applying various cutting tools to the surface as it spins. In the Buddha's day, this would have been a very simple process by which a strip of wood would be peeled from the rotating timber in either a long or a short traverse. The turner's whole attention has to be concentrated on the point at which the timber revolves, and this demands steady concentration, because a hesitation would leave a mark which would be hard to remove. Likewise, by means of the meditation technique, your consciousness becomes increasingly refined and you become more keenly aware of the breathing. As you bring your physical and mental energies into a state of tranquility and dynamic balance, you steadily identify yourself with the breath until there is only the subtlest mental activity around the breathing process. You are simply and brightly aware. When you are just starting the practice, your experience of the breath will be more or less the same as usual. But as the meditation moves into a different gear, you will perceive it more subtly, and it will become much more interesting to you, as though it were an entirely new experience. This signals that you are entering the phase known as access concentration, or upachara samadhi, a state in which meditation becomes lighter and more enjoyable, and distractions are easier to recognize and deal with. You feel buoyant, as though you are floating or expanding, and everything flows naturally and easily. This phase of meditation might be accompanied by experiences called samapatti. These are difficult to describe because they vary so much from person to person and from one time to another. They might take a visual form, perhaps a certain luminosity before the mind's eye, or arise as a kind of symbol in your state of awareness. All such phenomena are just signs that your concentration is becoming deeper. Your aim is to concentrate all the more deeply on your breathing, leaving these experiences to look after themselves, not dwelling on them or getting too interested in them. Gradually, if you keep your momentum, you will be able to go just a little further than access concentration to enter full mental absorption, or anapana samadhi, otherwise known in Pali as jhana and in Sanskrit as dhyana. In dhyana, you enter a crucial stage, passing beyond the psychological process of integrating the disparate aspects of yourself into true concentration. As long as you remain immersed in this state, you are no longer dependent on the physical senses for anchorage, a statement which makes more sense in experience than in words, it has to be said. Absorption in dhyana is inherently pleasurable. It is a highly positive state of integration and harmony, which moves consciousness, at least temporarily, into the realm of genuinely spiritual experience. It has longer-lasting effects, too. It is what is sometimes called weighty karma. That is, it has very powerful positive karmic consequences. It is a mistake to think of dhyana as passive, mild, and restful in a pleasantly vague way. It is an active, powerful state. But for all its skillfulness, dhyana is by no means the final goal of the mindfulness of breathing. Its main importance lies in the fact that it is the basis for the development of transcendental insight. The Sutta. In this way, he abides contemplating the body as a body internally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body externally, or he abides contemplating the body as a body both internally and externally. Or else he abides contemplating in the body its arising factors, or he abides contemplating in the body its vanishing factors, or he abides contemplating in the body both its arising and vanishing factors. Or else mindfulness that there is a body is simply established in him to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and mindfulness. And he abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how a bhikkhu abides, contemplating the body as a body. The way Buddhist meditation practices are described can make it seem as though some of them are designed to develop concentration, shamatha, while others are meant to develop insight, vipassana. In fact, though, all these practices are part of a single system of mental development, leading towards higher states of awareness. The aim of all Buddhist practice is ultimately transcendental insight, and there is thus no need to draw too clear a line between shamatha and vipassana meditation. The process is essentially the same. You start by becoming aware of the aspects of existence most immediately apparent to you, your own body and its functions. And then you narrow the field of concentration in order to cultivate the dhyanas. This preparatory stage can take the form of the mindfulness of breathing, or the metta-bhavana, the development of loving-kindness, or even a practice traditionally thought of as vipassana, the six-element practice, for instance. Whatever the method, you have to develop concentration as a first step if the reflective aspect of the practice is to be effective. Having narrowed the field of your attention to deepen your experience, you expand that field to increase the breadth of your vision, placing your experience of concentration, intensely absorbed as it is, within the broader perspective of vipassana. Without these two aspects, the harmonization of consciousness and the cultivation of insight, no system of meditation is complete. One tends not to think of the mindfulness of breathing as an insight practice, but in principle it is, just as much as practices more usually designated vipassana. The Satipatthana Sutta's description of the practice certainly suggests that it is. Vipassana is presented here as a stage of meditation, that stage of meditation, which follows on naturally from the concentration and tranquility established by the mindfulness of breathing. As this section of the sutta moves beyond the technical description of the establishment of concentration and around the breath, it goes into a series of more general reflections concerning the nature of breathing. The contemplation of the breath internally and externally, and of the origination and dissolution factors of the breath. Through these reflections, this is the intention, you eventually come to grasp the essential fragility of the breathing process. So it is possible to take a reflective attitude to the breath, as well as dwelling on the physical experience of breathing. Although these reflections are suggested here in the Satipatthana Sutta, such a reflective attitude is seldom mentioned in the Theravadin tradition, while in the Mahayana, vipassana practices, such as the six-element practice, may take over where the mindfulness of breathing leaves off. No doubt the six-element practice could be said to provide a more comprehensive method of channeling the same kinds of reflection. But to reflect on the nature of the breath is in essence to reflect on what the Buddhist tradition calls the three lakshanas, the three characteristics or marks of mundane existence, that it is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and insubstantial. And what could be more directly related to insight than that? The sutta instructs the practitioner to live contemplating in the body its arising factors or its vanishing factors. The meaning of this is quite straightforward. You contemplate all the factors or conditions that go to produce the breathing process, and in the absence of which it does not take place. It is essentially a recognition of the breath's contingent nature. As well as bringing to mind the physiological conditions affecting the rise and fall of the breath, you can also reflect that the breathing, as an intrinsic part of the body as a whole, is ultimately dependent upon the ignorance and craving that, under the law of karma, have brought that body into existence. The very impermanence of the body, you can further reflect, gives rise to its unsatisfactoriness. This is the second of the three marks of conditioned existence, the truth that all conditioned things are unsatisfactory, even potentially painful, because they cannot last forever. The breath, like the body, arises and passes away, and one day our breathing and our life will come to an end. To bring this reflection home, you can call to mind the inherent fragility of the breathing. Like the body, it is a delicate, vulnerable thing that is always susceptible to the unpredictable forces of the natural world. This inherent instability is something we share with all sentient beings, indeed with everything, which is presumably what is meant in the sutta by the exhortation to contemplate the body externally as well as internally. It could conceivably mean looking at the body from the outside as well as experiencing it subjectively from within, but it is usually taken to mean contemplation of the physical experience of others. In the later stages of the mindfulness of breathing, when you might be concentrating more on the development of insight, you can recollect that just as you are breathing, so too are all other living beings, or at least those that do breathe. In this way, you cultivate a feeling of solidarity with all other forms of life. As far as I know, this sort of reflection forms no specific part of the mindfulness of breathing, as it is usually practiced. But it is the natural result of sustained practice. You realize in a very immediate way that just as you are breathing in and out, so too are other beings. The mindfulness of breathing, practiced in this way, thus provides a corrective against an alienated or one-sided approach to spiritual life. It seems a shame that it is not standard practice. In reflecting that we share with all breathing beings the same body of air and the same material elements, we approach the third mark of conditioned existence, the fact that the distinction we make between ourselves and others is quite arbitrary. This is the truth of insubstantiality, the fact that the discrete and permanent self is only an illusion. We depend on other people for our existence, and we are very much like them. And when we die, the material elements of which we are all composed will disperse across the universe once more. The sutta thus refers to the monk's body not as his body, but as the body. There is no question here of I or mine. It's just the body. Reflecting in this way is not meant to alienate you from your body. You are trying to see it as an impersonal process, part of the universal rise and fall of things. It is another move towards a sense of solidarity with other beings. In this way, the sutta leads the meditator through the shamatha stages of calming and integrating consciousness around the breathing, through the various levels of absorbed concentration, and on to the contemplation of the inherent truths of conditioned existence, in preparation for the arising of transcendental insight. How the effort to develop insight within meditation is made is quite difficult to explain. You have to look actively for insight into the true nature of things, but without looking for it in any particular direction or in any particular way. It is a sort of active receptivity. You are actively holding yourself open to insight. These two aspects of the practice, receptivity to something outside yourself, so to speak, and an active searching, are equally important. The quest for insight demands exertion, not intellectual exertion, but a meditative, intuitive searching. Not trying to think your way to reality, but trying to see it directly. This is not to say that insight will necessarily arise directly as a result of insight practice. Sometimes it happens that you are trying too hard or in not quite the right way. When you release that effort, the momentum of your practice may continue to build up, and insight may suddenly strike you out of the blue when you are doing something ordinary like peeling potatoes. There is no situation, whether positive or negative, pleasant or painful, in which insight may not arise. All that is needed is mindfulness. This section of the sutta is therefore less about what you do in seated meditation than about what you take away from it. This is perhaps why it is so concise. Perhaps it is not advocating a thoroughgoing practice of vipassana at the end of the mindfulness of breathing, so much as simply making the point that mindfulness, especially in its more reflective, insightful aspects, is something to be carried over into all areas of our experience. Mindfulness is not just what you do when you're sitting at the foot of a tree in the forest or wherever you choose to meditate. Having clarified and unified your consciousness by means of the mindfulness of breathing, you are meant to reflect that the breathing is a precarious and fragile thing, and to carry that awareness with you all the time. This section of the sutta prepares the ground for what is to come later on, when the transition between seated meditation and the practice of mindfulness in daily life is addressed. It suggests that a continuity is established by becoming conscious of the body's impermanence, its internal and external qualities, and its existence simply as a body, regardless of your mental constructions around it.